Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Linda, for mentioning the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists. I was ordained by the Berkeley Fellowship over 30 years ago, the second minister to be ordained there, after Jeremy Taylor, the green worker. So that's part of what Sundays are for me, are always weaving together a past that includes my own past, my own history, and then the deeper history of our movement. So the first reading this morning is from my 1853 edition of the Universalist Book of Reference. It's a clear statement of the 19th century Universalist's deepest belief that no human being could ever be condemned to hell by a loving God. Heaven is the final home for all of God's creatures, they say. Here we go. A belief of anything short of universal holiness and happiness in the resurrection state would not only dishonor God, but it must destroy all happiness and consolation in the creature. None can rejoice in that faith which tells of an introduction of feeling, sentient beings into a state of unending woe, pain, and death. And much less could they rejoice when they reflect that such end is the result of this unasked-for existence, and the pleasure of God declared from the beginning. Yet it is a fact which cannot be denied that the end of man, old language, whatever it may be, will be such and such only as God has designed, even from the beginning. The next selection is even older. It's from the German shoemaker and mystic Jakob Böhme. We heard about him during our UU history class in the fall. It's from his book called Six Theosophic Points, written in 1620. He explains that hell is not to be understood as a place underground or as a place with any fixed physical location at all. He writes, "External reason supposes that hell is far from us, but it is near us. Everyone carries it in himself unless he kill the hellish poison with God's power and bud forth therefrom as a new twig, which the hellish quality cannot seize or touch. Thus, the fierce, wrathful kingdom can be extinguished by nothing, save only by God's light, by which it becomes holy, gentle, lovely, and full of joy." My sermon this morning will take us wandering between these two ideas of hell and hopefully bring us to a much better place than either. Speaking of better places, let's spend some time now in Deborah's music. Thank you. spent my whole day there. Anyway. I hope my readings didn't give you the impression that all old books take religion so seriously. American author Ambrose Bierce defined universalist like this in his sardonic Devil's Dictionary, which appeared in serial form between 1881 and 1906. Universalist, noun, one who foregoes the advantage of a hell for persons of another faith. In most of his entries in the Devil's Dictionary that pertain to religion, Bierce pillories what he found to be an irrational or hypocritical affair. He included Christian, noun, one who believes that the New Testament is a divinely inspired book, admirably suited to the spiritual needs of his neighbor. One who follows the teachings of Christ insofar as they are not inconsistent with a life of sin. I'd say that the universalist comes off pretty well here. One who foregoes the advantage of a hell for persons of another faith. Universalists believed in universal salvation, hence the name. They did not believe that certain souls were predestined to enjoy heaven while the majority would suffer in hell. Neither did they believe that a majority of good souls earned heaven while a wicked minority earned eternal punishment for what they'd done or not done on earth. They believed that heaven was for all human beings, no matter what they believed or how they worshipped. The effects of sin produced no pleasure, but the effects of sin would be suffered in this life. Some who were called the death and glory universalists or the ultra-universalists thought that heaven came right after death. Die, bang, you're in heaven. Others thought that there might be a period of correction for our misdeeds, perhaps lasting as long as 50,000 years. But all agreed that heaven would be home for all. They thought hell was an irrational notion. God was the source of existence and of all events, and as such must even be the source of sin, which he used as a teaching tool for the benefit of his creatures. God was all-loving and could not allow anyone to suffer for sins which had their origin with God himself. No finite being could commit an infinite sin and so deserve infinite punishment. Only God is finite, therefore even the devil can only be finite in his evil, so not even he could be condemned forever. They had things all worked out, just like Patty Jean did in our children's story. So poof, there's no hell for anyone. Not even for the devil, let alone persons of another faith. But if our universalist forebears could see a copy of today's Unitarian Universalist principles, they might be confused. What the devil, what the heck, happened to heaven and hell and eternal life and God and Jesus and everybody? They might suspect that those crafty Unitarians, besides putting their own name first after the two groups came together, had simply omitted the core teachings of the Universalist tradition. But after taking a closer look, I think they'd find some classic Universalist teachings hiding between the first principle, respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and the second, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. In the words inherent worth and every person, they would hear something about the blessedness of all God's creatures. Hearing the words justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, they might think, oh, that sounds familiar. Hell is unjust and inequitable because no finite creature could commit an infinite sin, nothing that would merit eternal punishment. Even if we could do that, our compassionate Creator would still restore us to, quote, universal holiness and happiness in the resurrection state. So yeah, seems familiar. Well, you should know that some supposedly orthodox churches of their day, called partialists by the universalists, preached that one of the positive pleasures of being in heaven would be to hear the cries of the damned as they roast in hell. Now they're moaning and groaning. The Universalists weren't content to just deny this assertion. They asked, even if the elect in heaven do not take pleasure in hearing the cries of the damned, do they simply ignore them? Or does God hide the fact of hell from the happy folk in heaven? That doesn't sound right. Surely the sheep must know that they've been separated from the goats. But if these gentle sheep can hear the bleating of the goats roasting down below, don't they suffer because of it? If not, what kind of sheep are they? Genuine grade A livestock? And if they do suffer, what the hell kind of heaven is this? Whether it's reserved for the majority of humankind or just a minority of sinners, the idea of hell contradicts justice, equity, and above all, compassion, both divine and human. No hell means no big hell or little hell. It means no hell at all and no one, not even a devil, inside of it. So if our predecessors, with all that God language, could visit us today, they would recognize their doctrines in the first and second principles. But it wouldn't take long for them to become aware of something dark and troubling. It almost always comes up in discussions of the principle of respect for the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Someone asks, isn't it possible to do such horrible things that you lose your inherent worth and dignity? And the inevitable question, what about Hitler? What about someone who made ovens for humans a matter of official policy? Our 19th century visitors would not understand this question until they began to hear about Hitler. Once they had heard, their faith just might be shaken. How can we be sure that there is no hell, or at least no one who deserves it? How much closer to infinite sin can you get than the things that Hitler did? Hitler would be a terrible problem for old Universalists visiting the future, some kind of time machine. But no partialist who came along with them would have a problem with finding a place for him. Hitler is in hell. He's the best example, if not the proof, that there must be a hell for at least some people, or at the very least, for one. What do you think? Is there one man in hell? Does he have a little mustache, and strut, and shout, and raging German? Is Adolf Hitler the one man in hell? Is there a special hell reserved for him? What's it like? Is there a devil down there with him, or is he alone, damned forever to be his own devil? In her poem, Watching Dark Circle, Denise Levertov writes of a recent military experiment, one which involved burning pigs alive. She says that men are willing to call the roasting of live pigs a simulation of certain conditions. It is not a simulation. The pigs, with their high-rated intelligence, their uncanny recognition of disaster, are real. Their agony, real agony, and the simulation of hell these men have carefully set up is hell itself, and they in it, dead in their lives. And what can redeem them? What can redeem them? The simulation of hell is hell itself, and they are in it. That is, those who create such simulations. Surely these words apply to Hitler and his followers, who created countless simulations of hell, using real people, not pigs or sheep or goats. Surely a man who created hell for others must be condemned to it himself. But imagine, if we had some sort of speaker hooked up to a microphone in his hell, so we could hear his screams or whimpers, do you think that this would enhance your enjoyment of heaven? Or of life here on this earth? And if you had a microphone here wired to a speaker in hell, do you know what you would say? Would you say, serves you right? Hot enough for you?
Yes.
Maybe go to hell, Hitler? Or just click the mic on and say nothing? The silent treatment, kind of a Twilight Zone idea there. Or do you think that you could speak words of comfort to someone like Adolf Hitler? Could you tell him you honestly believe that by and by he too will be in heaven in 50,000 years or so, or maybe 6 million? I'm sure you don't like thinking about Hitler. I don't like speaking about him, and I almost wish I'd never started. I had to get a lot of help. You know, I don't do many quotes in sermons, but there's a lot. I needed all the help I could get. To think of him is like entering a kind of hell, and it's hard to come out safely. His name can lead to a litany of Nazi crimes and victims and of being unable to speak of anything further. It's not my purpose to undertake such a recitation this morning or to give you a list of statistics, body counts, and numbers. Such lists sometimes just make us number and number. Right when we need to stay alert and ask, what do we make of Hitler? Did his nature, through his actions, become something other than human nature? Did he destroy his own inherent worth and dignity and turn into something completely other, that capital O other? Can we identify with him at all? Hitler himself was a master of this deadly serious business of identification. He identified his own resentment, hurt, rage with that of millions of his countrymen. Those millions in turn identified with him so much so that Heil Hitler became the standard way for people to greet each other as though Hitler was also there wherever two or more were gathered. Simultaneously, he identified the source of all this hurt with target groups of others. We are not like they are, he said, and they are not like us. They have no worth or dignity. Let's put them in camps, behind walls. We'll make them lay the bricks themselves. They'll build an oven later and pay for that, too, with their family's jewels and their own gold teeth. They'll build it and they'll pay for it. To identify is a matter of the head and heart, but our flesh can't escape the consequences. Hearing just what they wanted to hear, millions of workers and professionals, moms and dads, employed and unemployed, people just like us, cooperated with Hitler to create a simulation of hell, which must never be forgotten, where millions of others, workers and professionals, moms, dads, employed, unemployed, people just like us, died precisely because their counterparts outside its walls could not or would not identify with them. The poet writes that a simulation of hell is hell itself, and those who create it themselves are in it, dead in their lives, and what can redeem them? What can redeem them? Can we find anything in our principles that's up to the task? Anything that can offer such redemption today? The 19th century's over. The old universalists are dead. Is the price of creating hell for others to be in hell yourself? Doesn't such a hell seem to be just and equitable and even a reasonable hell to maintain? So if justice and equity won't do it, will compassion redeem the hell maker from hell? But can anyone honestly say they feel compassion enough to wish eternal holiness and happiness for somebody like Hitler? There's something I read recently, surprisingly enough, in a martial arts book. A certain guru once led a meditation workshop, the theme being the salvation of all living beings from the wheel of karma. All was going well until the Swami asked for prayers for the soul of Adolf Hitler. Outraged voices rose from all corners of the room that some beings were too evil to be redeemed and that his very proposal was an obscenity. The Swami took in all the rage and then wide-eyed asked, "Do you want him to come back then? Do you want him to come back? Could you pray for the soul of Hitler? Or only pray against it? Is it possible for someone to lose their inherent worth and dignity? It's certainly possible for you to lose it in my eyes. I know. I admit it. And for me to lose it in yours. It's certainly possible for me to lose mine in my own eyes. And it's quite possible for all this losing to happen at once. Loss of worth or dignity for one breeds it or feeds it in another and another, and a great storm of loss can grow into hell on earth. A war, a holocaust. At such times we may indeed be dead in our lives. Then what can redeem us? What can redeem us? Jakob Bruma wrote that external reason supposes that hell is far from us, but it is near us. Everyone carries it in himself. The fierce, wrathful kingdom can be extinguished by nothing, save only by God's light by which it becomes wholly gentle, lovely, and full of joy. Where can such light be found? Ambrose Bierce said that universalists were willing to forego the advantage of a hell below, a hell on earth, or a hell in our minds. Hell seems to offer us safe storage for the worst of all that's human. But why preserve that from which we would be free? Who's in the hell of your mind? A parent? A brother, a sister, an ex-spouse, an ex-partner, a friend who turned on you, someone who burned you, someone who put you through hell, through terrible darkness, pain, or pressure. So long as there's one person in your hell, won't you be able to find room for one more? Then another. Another and another, and what can redeem them apart from your compassion? Who can redeem them besides you yourself? Are you ready for hell to be empty and its walls to disappear? Are you ready to decreate hell? To decreate hell? That's universalism put in an active way. Decreate hell. People would sometimes challenge the old-time universalists, saying that in a world without hell, there would be nothing to keep people in line, nothing to make them serious about being good. Will people take you seriously without the threat of landing at least in your little hell for saying that one wrong word or making that one mistake? Better watch out. You could end up coming off like a clown if you give it up. I'm comfortable with that. The Unitarian poet E. Cummings wrote, "One winter afternoon, at the magical hour, when is becomes if, a bespangled clown standing on 8th Street handed me a flower. Nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. And why? Because without any doubt he was, whatever first and last, most people fear most, a mystery for which I've no word except alive. That is, completely alert and miraculously whole, with not merely a mind and a heart, but unquestionably a soul. Essentially poetic, or ethereally serious. A fine, not a coarse clown. No mob, but a person, and while never saying a word, who is anything but dumb, since the silence of himself sang like a bird. Most people have been heard, screaming for international measures that render hell rational. I thank heaven somebody's crazy enough to give me a daisy. May we all become as light as a bird or a clown, with no hell in our hearts or minds. And if we see it under construction anywhere in our world, let us witness and work and pray and play against it. Maintain your cheerful, playful kindness. I see that every time I'm here, before and after. Add a little bit of coffee and it becomes even more. Be crazy enough to pick up a daisy. Focus more on being joyful than on being right. Right, Justice? Right? More jump, less grump. Share your joy, and the righteousness might follow the light. Focus it into a daisy, a rose. It's amazing what tools like those can do to walls of fire and brimstone, of bigotry and hate. So may it be.